This is Jenny Allen, and you are listening to the Made for This podcast. Well, guys, literally this book was dedicated to Dr. Kurt Thompson. And there's no doubt this book wouldn't exist without him and the group of people that I've been in a cohort with beside him and how he's led us. And so, Dr. T, you had to be on this season because this book wouldn't exist without you. They had to cut the number of quotes I had from you. They were like, Jenny, you've got to reference other people besides just your therapist. I was like, yeah, I know, I've got to. But just know that like this is something that you can attest to that I do not do well. That you have literally taken an infant emotional child to writing a book about it. In the years we've known each other, Dr. Thompson, you would not disagree. Yeah.
Okay, two things. Please call me Kurt because that's, you know, okay.
I do call you Kurt.
Number one. And number two, I will quibble with your saying that you don't do this well. I think what we would say is like, which is true for all of us, is when we meet Jesus, we're just not very well practiced at living in God's realm. I don't have any practice at it. It's not like I'm bad at it. Like that we could say that, but what we really are meaning, it's like saying if I've never taken piano lessons, you could say I'm a bad pianist, but what you would really say is like you just haven't practiced playing the piano. So I get to say to all of our listeners that I don't know anyone who's worked any harder at practicing something that was not initially attractive to want to practice, because it's not easy for any of us. It's not easy for any of us. I mean, every single one of us is going to get to some place where there will be some part of our soul where the emotional content and pain of that is it's a room I don't want to go into. And I've just, it's been a joy to walk with you and our friends and watch everybody walk into rooms that have not been easy to walk into, but have been able to because we're not doing this by ourselves.
There's so many directions we could take this. I think back to when I wrote Get Out of Your Head, we had just come into each other's lives at that time. And I'm talking to you about it and you're nodding and you're listening and you're affirming me. But I could tell in your responses that you felt like it was missing something big. And again, we are so grateful. I stand by the words of Get Out of Your Head. They are biblical. They are true. They are scientifically proven.
Sure.
But they're lacking. And you knew it even back then. But you also probably could tell that I probably wasn't ready to go the places or lead anyone else to the places that you knew I would need to lead them.
Yeah. You know, Jenny, it's just, it is the case. Again, I'll say this, that's true for each one of us. I think that what you've said, the whole notion of are any of us ready for certain things? We don't do things that we're not ready to do because I don't do it because I'm afraid to do it. Sometimes I don't do it because I'm literally not aware that there is something that I need to do. But typically my not being aware of whatever that thing is, whatever that particular room is, whatever that particular relationship is, be it a current one or one from my past, the reason I might not even be aware of it is because I've worked really, really hard to not be aware of it. Mm-hmm. I've practiced not paying attention to that. And so it's only when other people start to ask us questions about what we want, what we long for, and what our fears are, what our shames are, wandering into that territory, nudging into it as we are able, that we then things start to get activated. You know, we start to feel things. Because there are a lot of questions that no one has ever asked us about our inner life, about our developmental lives and so forth. And so we don't even know to think about it. But as we do, we discover that there is the memory of the emotional gravity of all that is so powerful. And so it's the emotion that is the thing I want to avoid, the emotion that I feel, the pain, the fear, the shame, all those kinds of things. And so what I've watched you and the rest of the community do is gradually become increasingly confident that you can step into a room where you know something's not going to be comfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we have to practice doing. Yeah. We have to practice becoming experienced at something's in the room. And when I go in, I might be afraid. I might feel something, but I have now enough practiced memory of having others go with me into other rooms where I've had that experience and we've been able to sort that out. And so it doesn't mean that I get to a point where I am no longer ever, I'm never again afraid to walk into a particular room about my story or my memory or conflict. It's not that I look forward to walking into painful places. I might even still be aware that I'm afraid, but as we've talked about before, we say we want to learn to become unafraid of being afraid.
Mm.
Don't be afraid to be afraid. And that's the piece that we work on. We work on practicing building comfort and confidence at knowing that we're going to do a hard thing, but we are paying lots of attention to the presence of others who are with us, who walk into the room with us. And so that when we're glancing at the thing that is hard, we're not just staring at it and being overwhelmed by it. We are continually turning our glance back to the ones who are with us.
Yeah.
Listening to what they have to say about this thing that is difficult. And as we do that, we ease into our presence with it so that we can tell that story. And then that story can be transformed because the work of the Holy Spirit in the presence of the body of those who are with us. This is basic embodied transformation. I mean, this is the gospel. This is Jesus coming and healing people and then people having to make sense of what just happened. And we can tell a story because he has literally in an embodied way been so present with people that his presence begins to color in a very different way the distressing affect of my shame and my anger and this and that and so forth and so on. That's what I have witnessed you all doing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And with that practice, we become more effective at that.
Yeah. I want to go back to a moment where two moments that I write about in the book that a lot changed for me. And the first moment was, I'm sure you'll remember this one because it was so emotional. Our first gathering as a cohort, we were on a little retreat together and I showed up big, which was different from the first time we met. I brought all my emotions and then pretty quickly people started kind of correcting me in the room of God isn't like that, telling me what was true. And you were fierce and you fought for me. And I think you saw me sinking and I did feel a little betrayed in that moment by everyone. And I felt a little like they were judging me for what I was experiencing, feeling, you know, and that's kind of when you taught us, like, this is what we're going to say. We're going to say, I feel versus I think. And that was a real shift. And I would say if that hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't have believed how much it feels bad to be fixed, to try to be fixed with truth. I think so many people are like me, which is, they need convincing, like, gosh, if there's a problem to solve, let's solve it. But this wasn't a problem to solve. Like, these were emotions I'd been carrying for a long time.
Right. Well, and I think it's fair to say that one might say that we, as a human race, as the people for whom Jesus has come, we are not problems to be solved. We are sin and brokenness and disease of all kinds that Emmanuel comes to be with. And it is in the fullness of his withness with us that we allow him to touch the parts of us that even we don't want to touch, don't want to talk about. I mean, we have the woman in Mark 5 with the bleeding problem, and like she's doing everything she can to make sure she's not seen by anybody, including the master. And he's not having it. It's going to be a full-on, full-embodied encounter with someone who does not see her as a problem or that she has a problem because she's healed. And then what is she going to do? She doesn't have a job. She doesn't have a family. She doesn't yet have a full community. Like, she still has all the other stuff she's going to have to work through. And so I think that, you know, an example of that you're giving, one of the things that happens with us as communities of even communities of faith, but as human beings, you name what you feel that is painful, that is difficult. And in so doing, you evoke all of that similar stuff where it resides in everybody else in the room. And part of the reason why I want to rush so quickly to fix you, to give you logical, linear, cognitive truth is because I'm trying to reduce my own distress far more than I'm actually trying to help you. Helping you might be a byproduct. What I'm really trying to do is, you've named something that is like starting to stir stuff up in me. This happens all the time. This happens in the grocery store. This happens in the bedroom. This happens in the kitchen. This happens in elder board meetings. And so what I want to do is to reduce my own distress. So if I can give you a fast fact, if I can tell you something, then maybe you will stop naming what you're naming, and then I will be less anxious. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm not trying to be helpful. I am trying to be helpful, but I'm not aware that what I'm really trying to do primarily is reduce my distress. And in so doing, we're trying to force the brain to work against the grain of how God has made our minds to work. We talk about this notion that first we sense things, and only then do we make sense of what we sense. But if I do not first give you the felt embodied experience that I am sensing what you're sensing, that I am with you in your travail, that I am with you in your pain, it won't matter what truth I tell you cognitively. It won't matter. Your brain's not having it. It is not until you feel the withness of others, and you will then be able to be less anxious, such that you will then be able to imagine a different story that is true. So there is an order in which this has to come. And this is why when God comes in Genesis chapter 3 and comes calling, "Where are you?" He's not coming to kill them. He's coming to be with them. But they were so terrified of this that they couldn't let that happen. They weren't going to let him in. They weren't going to allow themselves to be loved. They couldn't do it. This is how powerful our shame is. We assume that this is the way we get things done, that we're going to fix things. And certainly, these are not mutually exclusive things. Like, if you have a ruptured aorta, like, we're not going to ask you how you feel about it. We're going to take action on this. But what gets me as the surgeon to the table is my felt sense of connection with someone who's in trouble. And so in a setting like this, in the settings of the church, what is far more significant is for us to actually live and move in acts of healing and do so according to how the mind is actually designed to work. I think what I watched happen was, in that one moment, was I watched you hold your ground long enough and not run out of the room. I mean, I don't mean that literally. I mean, not, right. You know, but I mean, not leave. Now, oh, well, who, I mean, yeah, because if somebody just wants to fix me, I want to leave.
That is a mic drop right there. If somebody wants to fix you, you want to leave. That is, and yet we're all running around trying to do it to each other because we think the problem is the circumstance, but the problem is way bigger.
Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should at least be simple. That's why for the last year and a half, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel nourished, strong, and ready to take on the day. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. The main reason that I have loved AG1 and loved partnering with them for so long on Made for This is because they have simplified my morning routine when it comes to vitamins and nourishing my body, because it shouldn't feel complicated. And I used to take a whole handful of different vitamins, like vitamin D, magnesium, like my multivitamin, my probiotic. It was just like way too much, very expensive. But AG1 has totally changed the game, because one daily scoop of AG1 covers all of my nutrient gaps and supports my mental and physical health without a ton of hassle. In just 60 seconds every morning, I know I'm giving my body what it needs and setting up sustainable habits for the long run. If there's one product I had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1. And that's why we've partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/madeforthis. That's drinkag1.com/madeforthis. Check it out.
let's talk about your, what I call magic. And it's very grocery word. Everybody's judging it. You already are like, I don't even know if I believe in therapy, like gospel, gospel, gospel. Yes. Like, so I am a gospel person who has seen the gospel embodied through this experience, because it's been Jesus's way of healing my soul in so many different ways.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Let's talk about the magic, because I'm going to go to another moment I talk about in the book where we were doing a private session one-on-one. You had me sharing, I was wanting to feel a breakthrough with this anxiety I have around work. And you got me sharing about pressure that I felt as a kid and where all this pressure comes from. And again, this has been a theme. And after that session, even though we've talked about this lots of times, but for some reason that day, triggers started coming up again that normally would have made me feel a lot of anxiety and panic with my work. And I didn't feel it. And when I followed back up with you later, I said, what happened? Because you didn't necessarily give me great advice. I mean, I'm not saying you didn't give me any, because you led me to some understanding that I needed, but largely it wasn't a cognitive transformation. Something had happened and I couldn't figure out what it was. Talk about what is happening when that happens.
So let's put it this way. In a book that I wrote called The Soul of Desire, we talk about this notion that we are people of great longing and we are people of great grief. And our griefs come in very small moments that we would look at and say, well, that's not grief. But moments like the kind that you and I talked about things that, you know, developmentally important moments that you would remember, we would say, in the scope of life, come on, Kurt, that's not that big of a deal. How could that be a big deal? And yet these small moments are ones that create rupture, that create wounds that we don't even know are happening at the time when that's happening for us. But they are griefs. And they are griefs that we hold literally, neurally, in our remembered, in the parts of our brains that do all the collective remembering. The primary fundamental first step toward healing of all grief is that our grief is seen. Our grief is seen. It's acknowledged. Somebody says, gosh, that was really hard. And you've been carrying that and suffering with that for a really long time. Richard Schwartz, the father of internal family systems, likes to talk about this whole notion of, we have many, many different parts of us that are represented by these different memories, these different childhood experiences, these different experiences that happened yesterday, in which, as I would put it, we've experienced grief in some significant way for which it has not been acknowledged and it has therefore not been healed. And when we read in Isaiah, he was a man of sorrows, like, my goodness, like, this is our king. Coming for us, coming for every single sorrow, because he knows that this is what it is like to be human. To be human is to be a person of grief. And we will have particular griefs that will continue to be really painful for us. And the way they will show up in our adult lives is through our anxiety. We get overwhelmed. We all of our performance stuff, all of our perfectionism stuff, and we translate this into our spiritual language. I don't just be perfect about being a good worker. Like, I've got to please God better. And it even affects the way I create my theology, the way I imagine God's talking to me, the way I'm imagining I'm talking to God, all this stuff, because like, it's the same brain. However, when those parts have the experience of being seen, soothed, acknowledged, validated, when they are not alone, remember, our suffering is primarily suffering because of our isolation with our pain. It's not just the pain that we have. It's the isolation that we have with it. And when that pain, that suffering is seen, it's transformed. It has the experience of, oh, I'm not by myself anymore. I'm continuing to have this felt sense of someone seeing me, caring for me, loving me, inviting me into the room, and beginning to tell me a different story. And that becomes things that happen to us, even in ways that are not necessarily cognitive in my thinking brain. It's taking place in the way that my brain has a felt sense of tranquility. I am a felt sense of I'm okay. And that felt sense of I am okay, because some part of me that has been continually, perpetually related to this piece of me that feels stressed about work, means that I can encounter the same circumstance with work, but the part of me that has been activated historically when that shows up is now much more comfortable and confident because it's not by herself.
I mean, I think it probably weekly, if not more, I should be feeling anxious right now and I don't. And it is so freeing. And what a great thing to have go through your mind. I should be anxious right now and I'm not. And I was anxious my whole life in moments like that. And I'm not.
Yeah.
And I'm more fierce and I'm more clear and I'm more confident than I've ever been in my life. And I absolutely know it is from healing those parts of me that are no longer throwing a tantrum every time I feel pressure, right?
Yeah, totally. And I want to say something about language, because I think this is important for our listeners to hear. When we say the words, the gospel, and we have everybody who hears this, the gospel, we have an idea in our head about what we think that means. And I want to suggest to our listeners that what we are talking about right now is the gospel. It is the gospel. You cannot separate. You know, we talk about the difference between talking about something and being with someone. We don't talk about anything without having first been with them. Paul doesn't write any of the stuff that he writes without first having had some encounter on the Damascus Road and then having some encounter with Ananias, who was scared to death to be with him. And then all the encounters that Paul has, those years in the desert, all these encounters that he has in his embodied self with the Holy Spirit and the risen Christ, now gets translated into the things that we talk about. When we read the gospel stories, the good news is not a separate thing from Jesus touching the leper. Like, there was no such thing as the gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John when Jesus was doing his work, but he was that healing presence. He was the gospel. And so I want to invite us to consider, you know, when we read the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus says, look, you give a cup of cold water to somebody in my name. Like, it is the gospel. And so there are many dimensions of this that I would want to invite us to recognize, that this work that you are doing is exemplary. It is the gospel. It's not the only example of how the gospel is working in the world. The gospel has an infinite array of embodied presence in the world. The gathering that's going to happen at IF, the gathering, the room, it is the gospel. We are the gospel. We, in the sense that we are filled with the Holy Spirit, we are Jesus' words, his facial expression, his tone of voice, his curiosity, his unwillingness to try to fix a problem before being with it.
So what you said to me after, when I'm like, what is this gospel magic? You said, you aren't alone anymore. That really did change things. And you mentioned earlier the brain and the fact that the way our brains were built by God was to not be alone in pain. Can you talk a little bit more about that theology?
Well, I mean, I think we probably all way underestimate the heft and the mystery of the first 10 chapters of the Bible. But not least of which the line in the second chapter of the Bible, where God is making the observation about Adam and his, you know, work in the garden and so forth. And he says, it's not good for the man to be alone. There's some, and you look around, you're like, Adam's not alone. He's got animals. He's got God. But there is some sense in which Adam is still missing a particular kind of withness, a kind of presence that God is saying, this is not enough. This is not enough. And when you take that reality, that it's not okay for us to be alone, and then you pass through the third chapter of Genesis where everything goes so wrong, that aloneness feature that's not good for us, even in paradise, even in its infancy of Eden, it is taken to extremes on the backside of our fall. And so evil exploits this notion that our pain is primarily about being alone. Eve and Adam, they turn away from God. I'm going to do this my way. And then suddenly, like, everybody's becoming increasingly alone. They hide from each other. They hide from God. You know, Cain takes off. I mean, the whole shooting match. And every act of violence is an act of me becoming more alone in an attempt to kind of reduce my distress as quickly as I can by myself, because I don't know any other way to do it. And so we find that when I get anxious, you know, like what happens when you share your feelings with the community and they want to fix things, it evokes the parts of them that feel alone and that feel the need to expeditiously do something to stop this. And this is what we're doing all the time, everywhere. We're just going to solve people's problems. This is the primary thing that we do.
I have to interrupt you and tell you what he does to us in the middle when we're doing this to each other, which we still do after being together almost 2 years. He stops us and says, he'll look right at me because I'll be worried about someone in the room and I'll be asking them questions and like coming to find them, I think, and which is good. That's a plus. That's a point. And I'm just kidding. Mm. And then he looks at me, like turns eyeballs at me and says, why are you doing that, Jenny? What are you feeling right now? What do you say? What are you feeling right now that you need to come for Lindsay? And I'm like, wait a minute, this is about Lindsay. I don't even want this to be about me. But then you sense that I'm uncomfortable with Lindsay's distress. Mm. And that, and you want to deal with even that. Mm-hmm. Like, you, but it, why?
Well,
like,
I mean, in that particular instance, it's because you're the one who's speaking. You're the one who's saying something. There might be other people in the room that are saying things without words. Because that happens sometimes too. I might look at somebody else who's got a certain look on their face and say, what's happening? Right? What's happening? What's happening for you? What are you feeling? Because the point is, because you're the one who's speaking, but not because you're the only one who's feeling things. It's entirely possible and is often the case in the community. And this is true, if again, in our small groups, in our church services, this is true. You may be the one who's naming something, you're the one who's talking, but it is fair to say that whatever you're feeling right then and there, it's true that there are other people in the room who are carrying the feeling. It's just that you're the one who's speaking for everybody. Because as my colleague Courtney likes to say, emotion is contagious. It's contagious. And so just because one person, like we've had experiences where one person feels something really intensely, and it's easy to think, oh, that one person is feeling something really intensely. And it may be that they are. It's also very likely that their intensity is an expression of the collective feeling of distress, of anger, fear, of shame, sadness that everybody is feeling. And so a lot of the work that you all, I mean, I think that you're all like this next level of depth of experience and practice is becoming increasingly aware, not just of what's happening with me, any one of us in the room, what's happening with me, but also asking the question, what's happening in the room? What's happening in the room? We have to remember, evil is not a neutral player in this. Evil does not like what you all are doing. What you are doing is moving against the gates of hell. Nothing short of this. And you collectively, you're not just a collection of individuals. You as a community form something that is bigger than the sum of your parts, some of the collection of all seven of you. And what that means is that as a community, you become someone that is a community supporting each of the individuals, but as a community, it's making chop in the water for evil's plans and intentions. And so there's no question that evil will want to do whatever it can to come against it. And so we have to pay attention to what's happening in the system.
Yeah.
At any given time, not just paying attention to what's happening within me.
It is springtime and the sun is starting to shine. My flowers are starting to bloom and I am loving that my natural hair texture, I can just work with it because I found pros and have never found beauty products that really understood my needs. And we all know your hair and skin can sway your mood and impact your day in ways that you can't underestimate. Ever since I switched to a custom hair and skin routine with Pros, I've noticed so many benefits. Healthier hair and skin, yes, but beyond that too. Pros is made for people, not hair and skin types. And so personalization is rooted in everything that they do, from their in-depth hair consultation to their made-to-order model. There are millions and millions of possible formulas, but only one of them is uniquely yours or mine. So my custom shampoo and conditioner bottles say my name on the front because they were formulated to make my hair more manageable, shiny, and hydrated, and they actually deliver. Pros isn't just better for you, it's better for the planet because they're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. And you guys know what's so great is that with every Pros order, you can tweak and adjust your formula to the season of life that you're in, if your hair has any changes, or if your hair goals change. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/madeforthis. So you get your free consultation and then 50% off at pros.com/madeforthis. That's PROSE.com/madeforthis.
Everybody knows this because anytime I talk about community, it comes up, well, I've been burned. And there's this sense that you get hurt and you walk away. And your big language is we don't leave the room. Like, we're not going to leave the room. We're going to face that thing that is making us want to walk away, mm-hmm. which is what you've done again That's and right. again. Describe, because so many people are jealous right now and they're like, well, I wish I could have Kurt Thompson and a bunch of amazing people in my small group. What would you say to people that are listening how they can do this in their context?
I think, as we may have said at other times, I think one of the most common questions I receive is where can I find this? Where can I find it? And my response is, I think that the better question is, how do I create this? These are not things we're going to find. It's how am I going to create this? And the first thing that I want to say is that this is not easy to do. If someone wanted to interview you and ask you, Jenny, how easy was this for you to want to do in the beginning, right? It's not easy to do. It wasn't easy for my wife and I. We're part of a small group that's been together for 30 years. The initial work that is like unto what we're talking about was not easy to do. We did not want to do it. My wife is a social worker. I'm a shrink. Like, we didn't want to do this. So the other thing that we would say is that, look, who knows, as Paul Borgman likes to ask, who knows how many people God had to ask before Abraham finally agreed to go with him into Canaan? Who knows? We don't know because there's no story. But we could predict, given who humans are, that God might have asked any number of people who said, no, I'm not doing this. We know that Jesus asked people who said, no, I got to go bury my dad. No, I got to go check out a piece of land. Like, who knows how many people Jesus asked before he got to Peter, James, and John, right, on the seashore? There may have been others that said, no. Jesus knows that this is not easy to do. People will have a hard time wanting to. People will think you're either odd at best, or crazy at worst. And these are Christians, just so you know, who might think that this is really strange, just like people thought that Jesus was strange. And so you ask one person and you might say, I'm going to pick one person that I trust. We're not just, you know, randomly choosing people off the street. And I want to pick one person that I trust. And I want to ask them if they would be willing to tell me, if they would be willing to listen to me tell their stories and they tell me theirs. I'm going to tell them my story and they're going to tell me theirs. And if they're willing to do it, then we're each going to find one other person before we even do this who would be willing to do this, so that we have at least three. And then there are ways in which we can go about just beginning simply to say, I want to give you the 20-minute version of my story. And of course, everybody's like wigged out of their mind because, like, what does that mean? What is our friend, my good friend Leslie, who's my literary agent? You know, she was the one who got us into all this trouble way back when she was part of our small group. This is over 30 years ago, and we decided we were going to tell our stories. And to this, and what she said, well, that night, she was the first to go, and she said, there are two stories that I could tell. The story that I could tell anybody that would be true, or I could tell you the real story.
Right.
And I've decided I'm going to tell you the real story. And wow, she did. And of course, it was jarring, because who tells this kind of vulnerable, who offers themselves up this vulnerably? And of course, we're all kind of briefly mad at her for kind of, like, you know, doing it in this way, because, like, how are we, you know, we're going to have to follow this. And so I would want to say to others, It's not hard because you're a pansy or because you're weak or because you're not good at this or whatever. It's not easy because evil does not want you doing this. God is about to transform your life. God has every intention of doing it and using community to do this. It will be done imperfectly. You will have ruptures that will need to be repaired. This is the case for me with my small group. It's the case for everybody. We've had ruptures that we need to repair in our group here. And in fact, we would say some of the most important ways in which groups strengthen is by having experiences of repairing ruptures. But I want people to be encouraged that Jesus came and asked people to do this kind of work. Come and give me your life, and I'm going to give you mine. I'm going to give you every single ounce, every part of me that you can tolerate, I'm going to give you.
So good, Kurt. I want this for all of you listening. I want you to have this, and I believe it's possible, but it is work. And you kind of have to say, okay, we're not going to leave the room, and we're going to talk about what's really going on. What are we really feeling? What are we really angry about? What just hurt you that I did? And you've got to start with the right people. But I really believe if people are craving this and they're committed to it and you don't leave, lives change. And I for sure can say that's been true for me.
And for me too. I mean, you know this. It's been a deep honor, and it's been very humbling to be able to walk with you all and watch you just work so hard.
You love us. Y'all should see us out like on our retreats. It's like seven women going to town talking and Kurt. And we go out to eat, and the waiters are like, dude, what did you do at this seat? Like, poor Kurt. Oh my gosh. We love you so much. What would we do without you? Seriously, there's so much in my life and the work that I'm doing right now that would not be happening without your gospel presence in my life. And for all of you that are like, I wish I had a Kurt Thompson, you get him. He has written some of my very favorite books on earth, Anatomy of the Soul. I read it multiple times before I ever met you. It is absolutely brilliant work. I reread all your stuff on emotions in that part before, or in that book again for a third or fourth time before I wrote this book. And then Soul of Desire is fantastic. Soul of Shame is my husband's very favorite book he's ever read. He tells people, we are just so grateful for your work and your ministry and how it's shaped all of us. Thank you, friend.
Did you know that Jenny has a YouTube, and we post videos up all the time? And so go to youtube.com and search Jenny Allen. We'll make sure to post it in the show notes as well. Share it with your friends. Pass it along to someone today. And we're so glad you guys were here. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Made for This podcast.